And bouncing back is about resiliency, right? And what do you learn from it?
It's about prioritizing our people, right? They're our greatest resources. And how you do that is by creating a culture of wellness for the organization.
Do I want to be a leader that just has power and authority, or did I want to be a leader that perhaps is transformational, can be authentic?
So I looked at critical communications points where people have to come in. It's absolutely critical that communication occur effectively.
And I say, be careful of the ladder of success. We all want to rise up the ladder, but the problem I have with the ladder is that one person can go at a time and you lose all cognizance as to where you came from.
Congratulations, Respond to Resilience, on your 100th episode, and thank you for the impact you are making on the industry.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Romoli. I'm David Dashinger.
A huge shout out for David, Bonnie, and Stacey for the 100th episode of Responder Resilience.
Hey, congratulations, Responder Resilience, on your 100th episode. Looking forward to another 100.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience. I'm David Dashinger. In this show, we're celebrating the 100th episode of this podcast. And to commemorate the occasion, we've created a special edition you can think of as the greatest hits of insightful interviews we've done about leadership. Remember, like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV. PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, all the podcast platforms, and go to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information.
This episode is made possible by Cover, an all-natural military-grade mineral sunscreen lotion. Providing broad-spectrum protection in an SPF 30, Cover blocks 97% of harmful UVA and UVB rays, but is light enough to allow your skin to breathe. First responders often spend long hours in the sun, and prolonged skin exposure is one of the hazards of the job. First responders love Cover because it won't stain clothing, and the 4-ounce bottle fits easily into a backpack or go bag. Go to kovr.respondertv.com to get 15% off all Cover sunscreen products. That's kovr.respondertv.com.
We'll be right back with our special Leaders Playbook episode featuring Chief Neil Gang, retired California Highway Patrol Assistant Chief Johnny Reddick, Captain Tom Rizzo, and the late Chief Bobby Halton, and the rest of our nationally recognized leadership experts right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMTB.
On this show, we're celebrating the 100th episode of Respond to Resilience. Since we began in the fall of 2021, we've interviewed an abundance of outstanding guests from law enforcement, EMS, fire, forensics, animal control, 911 dispatch, as well as experts on mental and physical wellness, all sharing insights into the vital topics for first responders. To celebrate, we've created a special episode, a greatest hits, if you will, compilation called The Leader's Playbook, gathered from the most insightful conversations we've had about leadership. Also on this episode, we'll be featuring a Resilience Toolbox segment with Chief Jason Corthell from Ironclad Wellness, spotlighting his groundbreaking mental wellness program for fire departments. First up is Chief Neil Gang, who's served in law enforcement for over 34 years and has been the Chief of Police for the Pinole, California Police Department since 2014. Chief Gang spoke with us about servant leadership and creating a culture of wellness in his agency.
So when you think about, you said something very interesting about becoming chief, that it wasn't about you, but it's about making a difference in your profession. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just because we see a lot of viewpoints, right? And there are a lot of different leadership styles, but that's a really great comment I want to hear more about.
Yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of leaders out there that are doing it for their resume and doing it for themselves, but it's really about being a servant leader. And I know that that word gets thrown around a lot, but really about just being there to help serve the people that are working in this profession. And I continue to say, and what drives me every day and my passion to get up every morning and put this uniform and badge on is my ability to provide resources to the people that are working in Pinole, but not just in Pinole, but be able to influence positively the entire profession. And really, again, that's what the passion that keeps driving me. And that's what keeps me every day, you know, getting dressed and enthusiastic about continuing to work in policing.
I think chiefs have a multitude of competing interests, responsibilities as well, right? Along with recruitment, retention. There's so many different topics that you have to tackle, but how do you let your people know in your organization that they're important in the busyness of leading? How do you do that on a day-to-day basis?
You know, for me, it's about prioritizing our people, right? They're our greatest resources. So we have to make them our top priority. And how you do that is by, you know, creating a culture of wellness for the organization, showing them that they come before the community. And I know that's difficult for a lot of police leaders to say, but it has to. And I'll just frame it like this. Could you imagine an NFL football coach that cared more about the people sitting in the seats than the people playing on the field? How successful would that team be? So it's the same thing for policing. We have to prioritize our people. It has to be our number one priority. And how we do that is creating a culture of wellness and then also establishing budgets, right? So we can have sustainable programs. And the bottom line is many chiefs out there have not have a budget string to deal with wellness. So how impactful is that to your people when you know you want to bring resources and initiatives, but there's no funding behind that? Uh-huh. So we have to prioritize that. We have to budget because what we prioritize is what we will budget. You know, we'll budget the next, greatest 21st century widget, but we're not prioritizing our people and putting funding where that needs to be. So here's the challenge. Instead of buying 10 new cars next year for your organization, buy 9 and put that $50,000 or $60,000 into a wellness budget. So you have those initiatives when people need it.
In a practical sense, as a leader in your organization, and maybe even applying to other leaders below you who are supervisors, how do you create that cultural wellness? Like, how much of it is policy? How much of it is informal, you know, just the way that people talk to each other in the department? Like, how does that kind of play out?
Yeah. And Dave, you and I had a conversation a little bit earlier about that. It's about the leadership of the organization, right? Leaders have to be able to take those conversations out of the shadows, share their experiences with their people. We have to normalize these type of conversations. So it's all the above, right? We have to have great policies in place, but it's more about the policies. It's about the actions and making sure that the leaders in your organization, that their words and their actions are congruent. Because the minute they're not, people will lose trust, and then your program is done. And the bottom line is there's so many people out there just doing checkbox programs. They really have to be impactful programs. And you're not just doing it for your community to hear or maybe your council or your political partners, but about people in your organization. They have to know they come first. And then you do that every day. And it's the same way I say the same way you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. You will not create a culture overnight. And you can't create a culture by checking off a box. It's the day-to-day interactions, the day-to-day steps, and the day-to-day conversations that you'll have that eventually one day you'll wake up and go, wow, we have a decent culture in this organization where people are willing to raise their hand, say, I need help, or even talk about, you know, the help that they're receiving. Can you imagine a day when you can go to a briefing and this, you know, these macho police officers who have never shared emotions in the past are now talking about which therapist people are using? It's amazing. So that is where it's really anecdotal. People say, well, how do you measure your success? Well, that sounds great on paper, but how you measure your success is when people in your organizations are talking about these freely and openly in briefings and throughout other interactions that you have with them.
Christian Hinojosa is a battalion chief with the Dallas Fire Department, and he's led their peer support program, providing outreach and support for firefighters. Chief Hinojosa shared his approach to maintaining situational awareness about the well-being of the firefighters under his supervision.
I think what's critical, and I'd love to know your thoughts on this, as a company officer, like how can we be more aware, more present, and recognize when somebody is struggling with a mental health or other problem? Like what are some of the signs, symptoms, and behaviors that might be signaling that they need help?
Sure. You know, I spent 10 years of my career as a company officer, and it was some of the most rewarding. It was the most rewarding years because of the relationships and the bonds that I built with my firefighters. I haven't been a battalion chief that long, but there has not been a day gone by that I have not missed my previous role for that specific reason. But I would say, you know, before answering your question, David, the first thing is that an officer needs to be present, needs to be aware, and really needs to be modeling that behavior that is expected. That means, you know, the officer, you know, again, this is my opinion, the officer should not be coming into work, you know, tired and hungover, and then expect that his or her work group is going to be fully up to speed. But beyond that, I would say, you know, the signs and symptoms, we are in such a unique role to observe. You know, I remember, you know, with my crew as a captain, I could come into work, you know, and before we even say a word, I actually know what's going on with my crew, you know. Yeah. I don't need to even talk to them. Their energy and their body language already tells me everything I need to know. So I would say that having an awareness of who we work with and being present is an important component. The signs and symptoms are going to vary. I don't think there's a generic response to that question. Obviously, if somebody is withdrawn, if somebody is showing up to work and doing the bare minimum to get their gear on the rig and then going back to lay down and sleep, I think if somebody is expressing frustration or anger, you know, maybe in having to make a run or maybe the way they're driving, I think all of those are signs and symptoms that we have to be paying attention to. But I think most importantly is we have to pay attention to when somebody starts acting different, you know, and it requires a lot of awareness, because one of the things we hear so frequently in and out of the fire service with the suicide and suicide attempts is, I had no idea that this was going on with that person. This is such a surprise. So the, you know, the quandary is how do we start having a better idea? And again, I go back to, you know, providing organizational support, providing mid-level management support, and having the conversations. You know, the silver lining to every crisis we've had with our firefighters that I've observed is that it leads to additional conversations. You know, some forced, some awkward, some compulsory because it may be a CISM type of format. But the fact of the matter is, we're having more conversations. That's a good thing.
Next up is Tom Rizzo, who's currently serving as the Investigations Division Commander at the rank of Captain. A national instructor and trainer, Tom published a best-selling book called Kapikaze, based on a series of lessons to help navigate a career in law enforcement. In this clip, Tom talks about the golden rule, vulnerability, ascending the ranks, and his choice to become part of the solution as a leader in his organization.
So if you could just give us a little bit of background on your experience of rising through the ranks, and what were some of the lessons that you learned as a leader that you are trying to pay forward?
So it's ironic. I never envisioned myself going for promotions. I was right out of the gate. I wanted to be involved in interdiction and proactive policing. Never envisioned myself wanting to go the supervisory or the administrative route. I was a, you know, I guess I would say I was a creature of my climate and my culture. I didn't like the leadership. And I don't say that in terms of that I thought I was better. I've never felt that way. I've always been an advocate, you know, I joined the military before I was in the police department, and I've always been an advocate of the right type of leadership. I'll follow into the gates of hell. So I just felt like I wasn't being led. And I wanted to, desperately wanted to be led. And I think a lot of us do. So I guess I reached that crossroad. Do I want to continue to perpetuate the problem, or do I want to be part of the solution and take control of my own destiny? Like anything else, and this is where I'm openly critical, in a first responder game, and I call it a game for a reason, everything is negotiable. So there's just ways to understand a system and then to go ahead and negotiate it. And nepotism exists. It's ripe. But I always felt like if you put yourself in the best position, you know, that standard deviation, you can almost allow yourself room to be promoted. So from early on, I had the mentality, I just wanted to lead other people like I wanted to be led. So it doesn't mean that I'm some type of presumptuous person. I live by the golden rule. I'm not religious, but I'm faithful. And I treat people like I'd want to be treated. I've made a ton of mistakes, though. So I think what sets me apart is I embrace my vulnerability. I admit openly my mistakes, my trials, my tribulations, all the same. But I firmly believe, and I also did something that was unique, and I embraced hypocrisy. I am all the time doing things and saying things that somebody could point and say, hey, Tom, you didn't do that, or you would have said blah. And I say, exactly. And that's why I'm telling you what I'm telling you right now. So I don't say I do it better. I do say that I do it uniquely. But I caution folks who reach out to me all the time and ask me for some guidance about ascending through the ranks. And I say, be careful of the ladder of success. We all want to rise up the ladder. But the problem I have with the ladder is that one person can go at a time and you lose all cognizance as to where you came from. I prefer the spiral staircase, and that's the way I've tried to live my life and my career, in terms of you can still get from the bottom to the top, albeit not as fast as a ladder, but you keep in touch with your former version of yourself, and you get to look out for the people that are ascending that staircase as well, because you're forced to constantly come back around as a 360 and do a reflection. So that's the way I like to do it.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy.
And it's so great to hear that, you know, you've made a concerted effort to stay in touch with where you came from, because it's an often repeated criticism that people that rise through the ranks lose touch of, you know, who they were when they first started out in this profession.
That's a fact. That's a fact. And I don't think that we'd be experiencing so much of the strife and the anxiety and the attrition that we're experiencing now if we would cure that one facet, just that one facet. And I say this openly. It doesn't you know, entail an increased budget. It doesn't entail fancy equipment. It entails empathy. That's it. It's free. It's free.
Johnny Reddick is a retired assistant chief and 29-year veteran with the California Highway Patrol, one of the largest police agencies in the country with over 12,000 employees. Her job was overseeing large-scale civil disturbance and officer-involved incidents, natural disaster response coordination and oversight, and managing hundreds of personnel within daily operations. In this excerpt, Johnny talks about her promotion process, explores the reasons to promote, and explains what it takes to be a transformational, authentic leader.
Leadership and taking a promotional exam are two very different things, but they should be one thing, right? So we can all kind of game the system and learn the process and make a promotional list. And then based on the way civil service exams work, or, you know, selections are made, you can be promoted. But this part of building your leadership acumen along the way is something we think we're doing, but we're not necessarily doing it just because we may be doing the job. And so I thought for many years, because I was doing the job, that when I wanted to promote to sergeant, that that would automatically translate into leadership. And two things happened. One is it didn't translate into either. In the sense of what I wanted, I had to take the sergeant's exam three times because I did not understand how to study, what to study, and how to pass a written test for knowledge on policy. And then the other part of that is your oral interview and how to be able to come in and communicate and convey your knowledge now in this process. And then once you actually get promoted, you're leading other people. You're responsible for others. It's not just being risk managers and making sure people are kind of compliant. You are a caregiver pretty much for those that are under your umbrella of responsibility. And so my sergeant kind of process for me became an aha. And at the same time, I had two small children while I was trying to study and prepare. And that started maturing me, right? Responsible for kids, being married and all that.
Right.
But when I gained the team of actual people who needed me in a different way, it really made me start thinking about what kind of leader do I want to be? Do I want to be a leader that just has power and authority? Or did I want to be a leader that perhaps is transformational, can be authentic, can really help people find their best selves along the way? And so that was really my reason for continuing to promote. Of course, there's always the incentive of being able to have pay and, you know, a few other luxuries that come along with it. But what I realized is it also gave me the influence to be able to help others achieve the things that they wanted to achieve, but also to give them voice in the rooms that I got to go to that they don't go to, get to go to. And then in that same vein, ones that I was never in, now I get to be in. And that's kind of how I look at my ascension up.
Congratulations, Responder Resilience, on your 100th episode, and thank you for the impact you are making on the industry.
Welcome to Responder Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Romoli. I'm David Dashinger.
A huge shout out for David, Bonnie, and Stacey for the 100th episode of Responder Resilience.
Hey, congratulations, Responder Resilience, on your 100th episode. Looking forward to another 100.
This episode is made possible by Cover, an all-natural military-grade mineral sunscreen lotion. Providing broad-spectrum protection in an SPF 30, Cover blocks 97% of harmful UVA and UVB rays, but is light enough to allow your skin to breathe. First responders often spend long hours in the sun, and prolonged skin exposure is one of the hazards of the job. First responders love Cover because it won't stain clothing, and the 4-ounce bottle fits easily into a backpack or go bag. Go to kovr.respondertv.com to get 15% off all Cover sunscreen products. That's kovr.respondertv.com.
We'll be back to hear from leadership experts Captain Ram Duckworth, Lieutenant Colonel Oakland McCullough, Chief David Ogden, Nick Poprosky, Chief John Lynch, and the late Chief Bobby Halton. But first, here's the latest edition of our Resilience Toolbox segment on how to build an in-house mental wellness program for fire departments. On this installment of Resilience Toolbox, we're speaking with Chief Jason Corthell. He's the Director of Ironclad Wellness and Division Chief of Training, Harris County, Texas, Emergency Services District 13. Jason and Dr. Liz Fletcher have created SOPs, SOGs, and other documentation to facilitate a groundbreaking emotional wellness program for optimal mental health. Please tell us a little bit about the mental wellness program you created for your agency. What was the purpose and vision behind it?
What I found out in my own experiences going through my own struggle is the complication behind seeking help and finding resources was overwhelming, and it kept me from doing so. And so not only did we want to make it uncomplicated for the firefighter, we wanted to make it able to be duplicated and then share that with other departments.
How did you come to create these documents? They include procedures and guidelines. What was the reason that they're necessary?
We wanted to take this serious. We wanted to make sure that the players in the game, for lack of better terms, were all taking it serious as well. That's from chaplaincy to our peer support group members to our licensed counselors. Mm-hmm. And so they line out expectations, they line out financial needs and financial wants.
I know part of your documentation includes an alliance with a group of mental health clinicians. Can you talk about exactly what the documents cover and what mental health conditions they address?
Yeah, so our MOU with our licensed clinicians covers a myriad of things. It covers counseling appointments for the firefighter, counseling appointments for the firefighter's family, play therapy. It also goes into our quarterly training program, which is a mandatory program for all members on shift for 3 shifts. And then it covers any financials that come with that, which isn't astronomical. It's actually very manageable. Mm-hmm. And then the final thing it covers is the embedment phase of our counselors.
So in this day and age with virtual and people still doing in person, how is the support and help delivered to your members?
Yeah, so we've been a big proponent of in-person support, and there is option for virtual if the firefighter requests that. Being in the station with the firefighters and these counselors coming in, a lot of times what we see is, you know, the firefighter didn't want to go out of his or her way, didn't want to make a lot of fuss with their schedule, didn't want to miss out on work, and so they took advantage of the counselor going to them. And seeing them. And then obviously we have a virtual element that's able to be activated as well. If that's what they perceive they need.
If I'm a department chief interested in starting a similar program, what do I need to know before I jump in and get it going?
First, I'd like to say that it costs a lot more to lose a firefighter than it does to provide these services for a firefighter. To really think about the benefits that this can have on a department, I would say a good percentage, an astronomical percentage, is at-home issues. And so if we can get these firefighters help that they need to solve the at-home issues so they're not bringing work to home and home to work in a negative way, I think that this is 100% worth the investment. And I think my fire chief would agree that at first when this program launched, he was skeptical at best, and he has turned around 180 degrees and really bought into this thing and is super excited about it. It makes me happy.
Where can people find the resources that you and your team have created, and can they be adapted for other departments' use?
If they would like to reach out to me, I really do like to explain the documents to these folks so they don't get lost in some of the translation. And my email address is jason@ironcladwellness.com. They can always reach out to me there. I'd love to have a phone conversation or Zoom meeting or in person, whatever their format needs. There are a lot of documents, and if I just dump them on your plate or I put them on a website and you know, you just print them off, they'll probably sit on the desk for a little bit.
Well, any tips or insights you've picked up since you started the program?
And I'll break it down to 2 main ones that really helped me is, obviously, don't go at it alone. I think having Dr. Fletcher with me through this process and even now really brings a sense of peace and solace to the process, where I'm your typical firefighter, where I just want to get this thing done, solve the problem, and go back home. Dr. Fletcher is complete opposite of that. She really wants to sit down, take her time, and that leads me into the other tip, which is measure twice and cut once. As cliche as it sounds, you know, back when we started this this initiative in 2016, when we thought this program up, I was thinking, man, we're going to get this thing done in 3 months. We're going to roll out a program. It's going to solve the world's problems, and we'll be done. It took us almost 5 years to roll out a successful program.
Thank you for sharing these critically important tools with us today in Resilience Toolbox.
Thank you.
Next up in the Leader's Playbook is Rami Duckworth, a career fire captain and paramedic EMS coordinator for the Ridgefield Fire Department in Connecticut. Ram is the author of chapters in EMS, fire, rescue, and medical textbooks, and has over 100 published articles in Fire and EMS magazines. We spoke with Ram about his recommendations for best practices in leadership communication skills and the importance of maintaining presence while listening.
I did a research project for my executive fire officer program on patient care handover. So I looked at critical communications points where people have to come in. It's absolutely critical that communication occur effectively because it's a military situation or an incident command situation or a crashing patient handover situation. And how do those communications work effectively? And so much of it is exactly the stuff that we've been describing. Eye contact, putting away stuff that you're doing, you know, someone who is taking a patient report like this is not really listening to you. Stop. There has to be eye contact. You know, we have to isolate other things as best we can. We can't always do that in every situation. Sometimes the firehouse is still noisy or the command ground is still noisy. But it all circles around to the stuff that we've been talking about. So although that was a individual research project that I did, it was part of the sort of the bigger executive fire officer program. And it made me say, hey, man, this isn't just for when I have to give a patient over at the hospital or I'm transferring command or intaking a report. These are all just good communication, effective communication techniques.
Right. And it's being present, I think, right? It's in that moment, whatever it is that you're doing, and a lot of these are extremely critical tasks. It's just being present to what you're doing and doing it with 100% of focus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our next excerpt is from our interview with retired Lieutenant Colonel Oakland McCullough, a nationally recognized keynote speaker and the author of Your Leadership Legacy, Becoming the Leader You Are Meant to Be. Oak's leadership presentation and his book are based on his 40 plus years of leadership experience, including 23 years as a combat arms officer in the U.S. Army. Oak discussed with us the challenges of stepping into a leadership role, taking advice, and how to lead people who are more senior than you.
What were some of the biggest challenges that you came across as you were stepping into a leadership role or advancing as a leader? What were some of the biggest challenges for you?
Yeah, I think the first challenge for me was at high school. Because I tell people all the time, if you can lead your peers, you can lead anybody. Because that's the hardest leadership position in the world, is to lead people that are equal to you. That's the hardest thing. So equal in rank or in status. Yeah. So if you can do that, that's great. So that was probably one of the hardest things, at least initially, which then helped me in the next step that I took. Because in the military, as you come in as a second lieutenant, you're a pretty young person and you're leading people who are much older than you usually. I'll give you an example. My first platoon, I took over as an infantry platoon leader, and I took it over. My platoon was already out on the live fire range. They were practicing dismounted live fire across an objective. So they were running across an objective, machine gun firing 5 feet in front of them as they were live bullets as they were running across. They hadn't done it live yet. They'd been practicing it all morning. I got there at noon, and my platoon sergeant, I remember him very well, Sergeant First Class Penson. He's about 6'6", 250-pound, big old country boy from Mississippi. He grabbed me by the shoulder, and he said, come on over here, sir. Let's go have lunch. And we went and sat underneath a tree, and we're eating an MRE lunch. And he said, look, sir, I was 24 years old. He said, look, sir, you're the platoon leader. We'll do things any way you want to do them. You're the boss. He said, but I've been in the Army for 23 years. He'd been in the Army almost as long as I'd been alive.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
He said, I've seen it done every which way it can be done. He said, if you're messing up, I'm going to tell you. If you still want to do it, we'll do it that way because you are the boss. He said, but I'm going to tell you when you're messing up. And I can remember times when I would try to make a decision without even talking to him, consulting him, asking his opinion. And I walk up to him. I say, hey, Sergeant Pinson, you know what I want to, this is what I want to do. And I tell him, and he'd look at me and he'd say, is that really what you want to do? And I say, well, I don't think so anymore.
Right.
Why would you not listen to somebody who'd been in the Army as long as you are?
Correct.
But, you know, that's one of the huge mistakes that young leaders make.
Right.
Is they think they know everything. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a weakness to ask questions and opinions and advice from somebody that works for them. And that's absolutely the wrong answer because they have the experience in that area. and you don't have all the experience, knowledge, skills, abilities. So use those people who have that in your organization that you have the privilege to lead.
Right. I think
that requires humility.
It does. Yeah. It does. And I think that's part of a servant leader is that you understand that it's not all about you. It's about that team. And you use the people on that team to the best of their ability. And you know, you're going to have some superstars and you're going to have some weak people. And your job as a leader, or certainly as a servant leader, is to use those superstars to the max amount you can without burning them out. And to make those weaker linked, the people who are the weaker links in your organization, have that professional development, have that training development to make them better so that you can use them more and use those skills and abilities that they bring. Because even at the weakest link, they're still going to have some abilities and skills that you can use.
Chief David Ogden has been a successful law enforcement executive for over 37 years. He's led positive transformation by changing the culture in his agency. Chief Ogden is a keynote speaker on leadership, organizational health, team building, and mental health. We talked with Chief Ogden about vulnerability-based trust and the ability to connect with others on a human level.
How does a leader break into those realms of talking about a healthy marriage or a healthy spirituality? How do you do that?
Look, building a team is about building vulnerability-based trust. Right. That's what's really important. And we have to kind of understand. I think you have to have a leader that's educated in that paradigm and understand what that means. You know, what does it mean for me to be vulnerable? Does it mean I come in and cry on your shoulder every single day? No. But what vulnerability trust to me means that, hey, Chief, I don't get this. I'm having a problem. Do you know where I can get help?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you can build that team relationship, that's good. Because, you know, in most organizations, you don't want to be vulnerable, right? You have that fear that, look, if I'm vulnerable, they see something's wrong with me, I'm not going to move up that ladder. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get that next promotion, that raise. I'm not going to get that special spot on the team. That's just not going to happen. But leaders have got to break that down and go, hey, this is life. Life happens, and you got to be willing to share that and be vulnerable. You know, I share with my guys, we just did last year, again, we had our first transition ever. So we had actually some of the people I brought aboard, which were extremely professional folks that I brought from the sheriff's office. Jennifer Treadwell, first female deputy chief that we'd ever had in this agency. I brought her aboard here. She just retired last year. And, you know, after almost 40 years of service, Detective John Allen, one of the best investigators, I think, in the country, headed up the Casey Anthony case. Everybody will know what that is. I brought him aboard. So they retired last year. So last year was the first time that we actually got to infuse and bring up an entire new chain of command from within the agency. So that was one of my goals, is that these guys could see my definition of success is to make you successful. That's really what I and I say, you've maybe heard it before, but the older I get, the more important long-term goals become. And my long-term goal is that I want to leave this successful where all these guys and ladies that are here can step in and fit my role. Matter of fact, they should be, you know, say, hey, Chief, we're sad for you to go, but just kind of move out of the way. We're ready to take over next.
Yeah, it's interesting because we feel it in this conversation, but your ability to connect with them on a human level is what builds their trust in you as the leader. To know that you're openly talking about your divorce or losing a child or any of the struggles that you've faced in your life gives them permission because you're already approachable. And we see that from 15 minutes of a conversation. And so it seems like just being you, it's so important who that leader is and what they're bringing to the table in terms of their own past and how vulnerable they're willing to be.
It's amazing how people open up when you're willing to be vulnerable first. Because listen, as cops and first responders, as medical clinicians, right? We're very attuned to human behavior and micro expressions and things like that. So we know when people aren't telling us the truth. Mm-hmm. And when people aren't telling you the truth, you don't want to build a relationship with that person. So, we did a leadership program for the entire command staff last year and then the entire agency. And when I do that, I kind of share, I kind of go back. A lot of people here now, they know what I just talked about as a part of history. There's only like five people left here that were a part of that history. So, you know, I share that, hey, this is what we went through. This is how we kind of rebuilt this team. You know, and oh, by the way, you know, as I'm working, as we're doing this, as we're eliminating the team, as we lost this, then that's usually where I kind of introduce, oh, by the way, you know, just it wasn't over, a little over a year ago, a year and a half ago, I lost my own son. Mm-hmm. You know, so the fact of the matter is, while we're going through all this stuff at work, right, sometimes people forget, well, I got a personal life too.
Yeah.
That seems to be affecting me, or that is affecting me, no doubt about it. That, you know, that absolutely affected my life. So I'm kind of willing to share that. And I think in the class I spoke at with David, I kind of share that a little bit.
Albie Bassett is the fire chief of the New Canaan, Connecticut Fire Department. He has 29 years of fire service experience and many of those years training and developing firefighters and officers to become better for themselves and the communities in which they serve. Among his many certifications and degrees, Albie holds a Master of Science in Industrial and Organizational Psychology. Here's an excerpt of our conversation with Albie about self-awareness and the value of leaders receiving feedback from others.
We may be good at this more on, say, the supervisor talking to the guys on the line, doing some kind of evaluation or feedback. Maybe it's an annual assessment. And we don't really do this, I don't believe, so well when it's officers, say peer-to-peer officers evaluating each other, or maybe even from chief down to some of the company officers. So having said that, what's the value in having others assess you and getting feedback?
It goes self-awareness. It's huge to hear that and, you know, be honest, tell me what's going on there. It's, you know, getting, you know, in performance appraisal, sometimes that's called 360 evaluation. You're getting it from your subordinates, you know, in business, you're getting it from your customers and so on. But just me hearing somebody that's below me to say, hey, this probably isn't the best way to do things, or you didn't handle that right, you know, is opening. You know, I might not change my mind, but it's like, okay, I'll remember that for next time. And I had a great, when I was a shift commander, I had a great captain that would, you know, come in and reel me back in sometimes when I did something, maybe in spite. And I can't say I didn't, but he's like, you know, and I had a lieutenant too that did that. He was good. We came on together. He would come to me. He's like, yeah, you might not have wanted to go down that road, you know, and I get it, you know, and I listen and I learn from next time and how I want to handle that and push it forward, because it's not sometimes, yeah, it's not the best choice that you do. So hearing that feedback is very important.
Nick Poprosky is an award-winning paramedic and educator with experience working in municipal, fire-based, commercial, and volunteer EMS systems. At the time of this interview, Nick served as the Director of Education, Safety, and Wellness for a 300-employee EMS staffing company based in Connecticut. At the time of this interview, John Lynch was chief of police in Wilton, Connecticut, where John's department had a 97% community approval rating. Currently, he's chief of police in the town of New Shoreham, Rhode Island. Nick and John spoke about the role of supervisors, open communication with members, and the value of attending peer support groups.
Having come from the firehouse culture that I have come from, the kitchen table and the locker room are places where a lot of heated discussions and debates happen as far as, you know, how the leadership is, how they're doing, right? Are they doing a good job? What they could be doing better with how they screwed up? As leaders, how do you stay in touch with your members? I know both of you attend the Friday Fairfield County Trauma Response Team peer support group. Is that helpful in kind of getting a read on what's going on with the rank and file and with your other peers in emergency services? I'll throw that one to you, Nick, first.
I think one of the biggest challenges that I've had in, you know, kind of moving up to the position that I'm in is, you know, I have a number of site managers or direct supervisors that report to me, and then all of our staff report to those site managers. So I'm two levels detached from, quote unquote, the rank and file. I do think that, you know, attending the peer support group does, you know, help me remember, you know, that the particular set of challenges that you face as a field provider. But, you know, I think John was starting to talk about this a second ago when your direct supervisors are really, in my case, at least, they're the core of my organization. Because of that dynamic, I have to rely on them to both be checking on their staff and reporting up to me as necessary anything that's actionable on my part. So, you know, it's with 300 employees, no matter how you structure your upper management, you're not going to have FaceTime with that many people. Even in a 35 or 40 man department, you can't possibly know, you know, how everybody's doing. So you have to rely very heavily on your direct supervisors to kind of keep an eye on everyone and, you know, let you know if there's something else that needs to be done. So that's the main thing. I rely very heavily on my site managers to kind of check the temperature. And an important component of that is like John was talking about, is you know, creating that open door environment. It's not just about saying, hey, I have an open door policy. It's making the time when someone does come to you with an issue to you know, really listen and actively listen and attempt to validate the problems that someone's having and then, you know, try to facilitate a solution. In my case, I rely very heavily on our site managers and, you know, tell me, hey, how's everybody doing? What's going on? What do you need?
Chief, from your perspective, how do you maintain clear communication channels with your members? And part B is, does attending the peer support meeting help you become a better leader?
So, yes, to the peer support, but I'll explain that. So, you know, as a patrolman going through the ranks and even as a lieutenant, you know, venting is normal. You know, you need to vent. I did my fair share of it. Did I mean everything? No, it's frustration. It's venting. And to Nick's point is that you definitely need to have that open communication, especially like you mentioned your staff people, you know, boots on the ground, kind of the sergeants fill that role for us. So if something's going on or somebody's not doing well, whether it's financially, emotionally, or, you know, family related, you know, if that's not coming up to my level, then I'm not doing a good job getting there. So I will say, you know, we do meet with the union, you know, which is an employee group representative of the members. And we hadn't met, I don't know if it was because of COVID, and we hadn't met in a year. So I was concerned that, you know, we need to meet. So we met and we really had nothing to discuss. And we were kind of kidding around. It just says that we have this open communication. So we resolve these issues, one, before they become an issue. And two, we're always seeking their input. So they feel part of that whole process. You know, it's a sense of ownership that we're all very proud of. And then as far as the Friday or peer group meetings, I'm always one to try to listen to other perspectives. I'm very open-minded, and it really has helped me because, you know, I have some family issues over the years. Most have been resolved, thankfully, because of peer support, but I do get an understanding of what others are experiencing and their frustration, and I can't solve it, but maybe I can offer some hope and maybe some clarity on certain things. So for me, it's incredibly helpful. I hope it's helpful for them.
We were fortunate to interview Chief Bobby Halton a few weeks before he passed away in 2022. Bobby was a 40-year fire service veteran, author of over 400 articles, and he delivered more than 1,000 speeches. At the time of his passing, Bobby was editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering Magazine and vice president of education and training for Clarion Fire and Rescue. Bobby shared his perspective with me about resilient leaders, citing, as he often did, iconic examples from history of leaders who faced setbacks and who kept moving forward undeterred.
Talking about leadership, I was reading something you wrote about leadership. You said, we recognize that leaders are the people who spring back after a setback, who accept alterations with grace, and who view roadblocks as opportunities. What are some of the personalities that firefighters have that you've encountered that sets them apart as leaders?
Wow, that's a great question. I think just that, and obviously your podcast is called, you know, Responder Resilience, and bouncing back is about resiliency, right? Mm-hmm. And what do you learn from it, right? Like we've all been to jobs, whether it's a fire or extrication, where in hindsight we say, well, you know, if we had done this, right? Now, what you have to be careful about with that 50-50 hindsight is that you may be wrong. You know, you don't have a crystal ball, you know, and in scenario planning, it just provides you with another alternative, which is a good thing. The more alternatives you can think of, the better, right?
Right, right.
So in terms of resiliency or setbacks, it gives you an opportunity. I think it was, maybe Edison who said that, you know, that somebody said they did 10,000 light bulbs before his worked. Edison said that's 10,000 opportunities to learn, right? 10,000 opportunities to maybe get it right. Mm-hmm. And he's right. The problem for us in the real world is we're not building light bulbs. We're putting ourselves into high risk, highly dynamic situations. I think that's part of resiliency, right? Like, okay, it didn't work out, but you're still open to trying to get there. But what's the path, right? What's the path? And I think firefighters early on learn that we don't win all the time. And I think that's part of what we have to make really clear to all our recruits, that we don't win all the time. Sometimes, you know, the car accident's worse than we can, you know, extricate. Sometimes the fire claims the victims before we get there. You know, nothing is going to change that. So I think that accepting that life is a wickedly complex, dynamically difficult event. And so resiliency and failure is about seeking the truth, how to get something done, how to complete something. Okay, it didn't work. Probably one of the best examples historically for us, a man we all admire, is right over my shoulder, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln failed at just about everything he ever did. And he was in Congress for, I believe, two or three terms before he ran for president, and then lost a reelection bid or something like that. But he didn't quit. He didn't, you know, I didn't win. I'm going to take my, you know, ideas and go away. No, he kept going, you know, and turned out to be probably one of the most important men who's ever existed in terms of keeping our union alive and all the good that came from our union being alive. And clearly perseverance and being to get up after an obstacle was part of it.
We want to thank you for watching the 100th episode of Respond to Resilience. Bonnie, Stacy, and I want to thank all of our guests who continue to make this show possible, and especially thank the guests on this episode who shared lessons in leadership with their perspectives and wisdom from the front lines of public safety. We'll return to our regular show format next week, but we want to remind you to like and subscribe. YouTube, Respond to Resilience, Facebook, Respond to Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, PBSRadio.com, and all the podcast platforms, and visit our website, ResponderTV.com, for past episodes and guest information. Until the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.